The Big Picture, brought to you by Bible Society Australia, shining the light of God's Word into every corner of your world. And Sydney's Hope 103.2, there's always hope. The Big Picture, a Christian insight on the world of film, television and popular culture, with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley.
G'day, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm Mark Hadley, and welcome to The Big Picture for Monday, April the 2nd. Coming up on today's show,
we're going to get all earnest and lesson heavy as we set our sights on this week's attempt at a thinking action person's film, The Gunman.
And I get to share with you not only my favourite Learn the Lesson film, but my favourite heroic soundtracks as well.
And you're doing that because this is Avengers week, people. So in our What Your Kids Are Watching segment later in the show, we're going to take a long, hard look at possibly the biggest box office film ever, well, at least up until this point, Avengers Age of Ultron. So that's what's coming up in the show, Mark, because this is Avengers week, as I just said, and this show is going to be largely devoted to the Avengers, or at least we're going to talk about the Avengers so much all the way through the show until we actually start talking about the Avengers.
Eventually we will. You've got to hang in for this because we're going to have great Avengers fun. In fact, it's heroic, the entire, let's call it the heroic episode.
Yeah. So that's a promise. We are going to talk about the Avengers Age of Ultron, which hits cinemas this week. But first, we're going to talk about, in our now showing segment, a much different film called Testament of Youth, because also, as well as this being Avengers week, actually it should be around the other way. This is Anzac week. Avengers week just happens to fall into it. This is Anzac week. And the eyes of all free-to-air programmers will be looking at World War One, which means we're going to be as well. But also in cinemas this week, there's Testament of Youth. And Mark took a look at this World War One release. Here's a bit from the trailer before Mark tells us more about it.
You're studying.
What of it?
Nothing. Hey, look, I've done the Oxford entrance exams. It's all about technique. I could help you once you've learnt it. You'll sail through, I'm sure.
Like a Masonic secret. Passed from teacher to boy.
Actually, my teachers weren't that good. I worked it out for myself.
And so will I.
Based on the life of leading 20th century feminist Vera Brittain, Testament of Youth chronicles basically her struggles to become a writer, and then even as she emerges, you know, from basically the sort of patriarchal society that tries to stop her doing that, the international shadows of war and conflict sort of descend over England and the rest of Europe. Now, Alicia Vikander stars as the young woman who manages to fight her way to Oxford University and you see her brother and her closest friends then be shipped off to the war. And as the fatalities begin to mount, she signs up and serves as a voluntary aid detachment nurse in London, then Malta and France, giving her basically a first-hand experience of what it is to be involved in this huge generation of conflict. You know, and the tragedy that unfolds for Vera is both visceral in this film, it's actually really quite disturbing, but it's also emotional too. It's not just a film about explosions and barbed wire. What emerges is really a slow-burning tale that details the burdens borne by women held in distance by war, but required to suffer all the same.
Now, the clip that we just played from the film, I called it a trailer, but it was actually a scene from the film. And just judging on that, you think it's a film about women rising above society's expectations. So is this film actually a war film, Testament of Youth, or is it more a triumph of feminism?
It would be really hard for this film not to be about feminism because it's about Vera Brittain. Vera Brittain is basically one of the most notable feminists of the last century. So incredible woman who did so much to draw attention to women's gains. But that said, the real heart of this film is about World War One, and it is about the betrayal of a generation.
That's, yeah, I'm with you. I saw it as well and didn't think it was flying the flag that strongly for feminism, really. It's more of an undercurrent in the film.
Yeah, in some respects, it's almost done away with in the first 20 minutes. You know, yeah. It's like she tries to get to college and then she gets there and that's great. But really, it is about this sort of sense of a bait and switch. That, you know, the same klaxon calls and brass bands that called Australians to the shores of Gallipoli also did the same for British, you know, subjects and took young men off to the continent. And they rang just as hollow, you know, when they arrived. And so Vera Brittain, and in fact, Testament of Youth is a testimony about the lie that is, you know, often sold with war.
So what do you think it is that Vera actually learns about war? I thought watching Testament of Youth, it's a great celebration also of the effort that women put in during World War One, which often could be overlooked in these kind of movies. That's, but what do you think Vera learns about war? And then, therefore, what does she help us as viewers learn as we're watching Testament of Youth?
One of the first things we learn, like you said, is because it tells us so much about what women go through. And, in fact, not just women who decide to become nurses and then serve on the front lines or back from the lines, so to speak, but women at home, is it reminds us that war is something that just encapsulates an entire society. People who are at home waiting for a letter to find out whether or not somebody is still alive are in their own personal hell, right next to those people who are struggling along on the front line themselves. So I think the first thing she learns about war is that it is actually an all-encompassing thing. It betrays every level of society. But the second thing she learns about it is that there's just no peace to be found in vengeance. There's this brilliant scene halfway through the film where she actually appears at a rally for people who are basically trying to talk about how much Germany should be punished post the war, you know, reparations and things like that. And she actually says, look, do you think this is going to bring your husband back? Do you think this is going to bring your son back? It's not going to achieve anything. Don't you think they're suffering just as much as we are?
Mm.
You know, and yeah, so that's one of the great things about it.
Yeah. I found it a bit subdued, though, really, Testament of Youth. Yeah. I don't know if I'd be suggesting people race out the cinemas. As we banged on at the start of this show and as we're going to continue to bang on throughout it, the Avengers Age of Ultron is at cinemas, is going to dominate everything. Testament of Youth has been released during that week. What do you think that says about a movie like Testament of Youth?
I think that this is one of those films for people who, well, look, you know, you can have the candy floss of Avengers, which, by the way, is bright and shiny and should be enjoyed in all sort of degrees, but there's some films that you just want to go and think about. It's like, you know, when my wife, I went and saw, before I didn't take my whole family to go see Passion, Passion of the Christ, but I remember seeing it and my wife saying, look, what was it like? Should I go see it? And immediately, Testament of Youth is like that sort of film. It's one of those films where you want to say...
Not nearly as graphic,
not,
as traumatic,
nowhere
though.
Near as graphic, but you want to say, yes, you should see it, and gee, it's going to be a painful experience. It's a one-watch film in which you learn a great deal in the process.
So it sounds like for you, and it stirred it up in me as well, a lot of thinking about war, the futility of war, what's it all about, et cetera, et cetera. As Christians... What do you think the Bible's got to tell us about war?
So Mark,
want to dive into that sort of terrain? So you come out of something like Testament of Youth thinking, oh, well, like it's not just a movie. This is real. This happens. What do you think the Bible's got to tell us about war?
Well, Testament of Youth is a really strong argument against war. I mean, let's just face it. It's an anti-war film. It's a pacifist film. And so it's well worth us asking as Christians, is that the line that we should be taking?
Should we be for or against it?
Yeah, is the Bible for or against war? Now, the problem is that we've got to remember that terrible things happen during war, but this is going to sound trite, but terrible things happen at school, or terrible things happen on overseas trips. Terrible things can happen on a telephone call. These are often the settings, you know, for terrible things. War in itself has the ability to be both terrible and righteous at the same time. I think we do ourselves a disservice if we forget that there's such a thing as a merciful war. In fact, war is the last reach of diplomacy to try and stop something terrible happening. Now, Testament of Youth points out that World War One was very much about thrones and empires,
dominance,
and jockeying, and there was a lot of propaganda going on. So I don't think it's a great example of a war that...
It's not a righteous war.
And yet, the same generation participates in a war just a couple of decades later called World War II, in which there was so much about that war, which was about an attempt to stop the unrighteous occupation of another nation, the decimation of the Jewish people. In fact, for that matter, what was happening to the Slavs in Russia? Terrible things were going on, and for many people, what was happening there really was a war of mercy and an attempt to try and stop things. So if we say there's no such thing as a good war, we're really setting ourselves up for a statement to say that some things should be allowed to continue no matter what. And God doesn't take that attitude. I'm not trying to delve into the Old Testament or make people feel uncomfortable about some of the things that go on there. I know that's tricky theology, but immersed
but
war.
But worth diving into, yeah, and worth exploring and thinking about, and what detail, is the presentation of in war detail, in detail.
Yeah, when you get a chance. But I would say, just in capping the idea, that a merciful war might be a way that we would describe what God does in the way of sin. You know, God declares war on sin and basically sacrifices his own son. In fact, Jesus goes willingly into the fight for the sake of us. Now, that's a merciful war. And there's huge suffering. There's no suffering, as we understand it, that any man has ever gone through more than what Christ went through on the cross. And yet, it was for a purpose that was well worth, you know, gaining, and that is our own salvation. So, is war okay by the Bible? Well, some wars are, yeah.
So you came out of Testament of you thinking all of that stuff about war. Does that mean then, to wrap up our now showing segment this week about Testament of Youth now in cinemas, that people should go to see Testament of Youth?
Look, I would go and see it as a thinking exercise. I won't say that this is the most riveting film I've ever seen, but I got to say, my eyes were open to it. And we're going to come back to that a little later in the show, guys, because we're going to be talking about films that actually open your eyes. They might be the one-watch film, but they're really worth seeing, if only to wake up a little and see the world around you. Well, coming up now, we're going to have a look at another one of those big thinking films. You know, before we arrive at the Avengers action extravaganza...
We're not talking about the Avengers yet?
Not yet, but let's just say...
Probably we will be talking about it.
We will be talking about Avengers coming up. It's champing at the bit over here. A little too much sugar on the breakfast cereal. Now, anyway, before we arrive at Avengers, there's a new film out this week which contains basically action, but it's an unexpected aging action man. Oscar winner Sean Penn stars in The Gunman, the latest screen mission for an assassin forced to fight to keep his own life out of the sights.
I did some bad things.
Tell me.
We thought we were helping, but it didn't work out that way.
You always worried too much, Jim. The past is the past, my friend.
You keep a diary of the horror we created.
It never happened.
That's the way you want to play it?
With me?
You did your part, I did mine. We all found a way to justify it.
Keep your eyes open, my friend. It's the ones who aren't after you that do you in the end.
Sean Penn as an assassin.
Can you believe it?
Alongside Javier Bardem, Idris Elba, and Ray Winston. Okay, so this has got to be epic. There must be something to The Gunman, right?
No. you would expect, I'm with you, you would definitely expect that.
I was working to build that up, but thank you for just...
It's like that one-word review, no. The Gunman is a massive disappointment. I think it's the biggest disappointment for me this year because of all of these elements, and particularly if Sean Penn is in this. Now, Sean Penn, a serious actor, Oscar winner, known for deep roles, everything from Dead Man Walking to Mystic River, but the fact that he chose an assassin movie, and as you mentioned just before we played that clip, it is one of those assassin movies where assassin gets dragged out of retirement because someone's trying to kill him for some blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera.
How many... Do assassins have a retirement plan? Because it just seems if you're an assassin, it's guaranteed that at some point somebody's going to say, listen, you have to come out of retirement.
Have they
not concentrated on the industry enough?
Haven't they watched movies that have done this? So The Gunman, I was amazed at how straightforward it actually is. It's from a director called Pierre Morel, who was responsible for turning Liam Neeson into an action hero in the film Taken, which I found repugnant. I really did not like that film at all. I didn't find this as repugnant, but I did find it not just disappointing, but it gets increasingly offensive. And the reason for that, particularly, not just as a wasted opportunity with Sean Penn, it's a wasted opportunity because this film is set in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which is one of the world's tinderboxes. It's a country in Africa that we sort of hear nothing about really in the West, but so much goes on there in terms of civil warfare and corporate greed and resources plundering, all this kind of thing. That's the backdrop of The Gunman. But they basically just use it as wallpaper in this film.
So it's basically a series of pot plants in the background while they... we're in the Congo, people.
That's it. It starts there, it kind of crops up, but largely The Gunman, oh my goodness, is so predictable, it's almost ridiculous. You can't believe they've actually made it.
What is it about hired guns and Hollywood? Like, it seems... I wonder about this because, you know, we seem to feel like it's okay, whether it be James Bond or Jason Bourne or someone. So long as we've got a hired gun, that's... also qualifies as a hero in a heroic action week. Is a hired gun really a hero?
Well, that's right. As long as it's a professional job, it seems okay. That, and as long as they're kind of slick and cool, like the particular ones you just mentioned, Jason Bourne, James Bond, they are these slick but human superheroes. And I think we often can express a sympathy or a like. We like these kind of anti-hero. They're usually guys, but there are women that play assassins on screen. Everyone from Angelina Jolie to this French movie called La Femme Nikita, which was fantastic about an assassin. But I think what we like about why we've got sympathy and why we like what they do is because they're often not treated as the bad guy. Clearly, the people in these movies are bad. You know who the bad guys are. You know who the villains are. They're usually more villainous. They're just more villainous, and often they're twiddle mustaches and that kind of thing. So you know who the bad guys are. So therefore, the assassin isn't necessarily the bad guy. Even if they're doing bad things, they're often for good reasons, or they end up being for good reasons. So as a result, you can forgive them for that and forget what their job is because they're kind of just getting the job done. They're either keeping people safe or keeping loved ones safe, or there's some kind of reason that they're doing what they're doing. The gunman tries to present that as well. Post-traumatic stress turns up in this as something of almost like a reason for what he's doing or not doing, as the case may be. Love turns up, all this sort of stuff, and even a little bit of thrown in there nobility for what's going on in the Congo, which I found a little bit offensive the longer the movie went along.
It was interesting you talk about the Congo because you mentioned the government's set in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and it's one of the planet's most war-ravaged nations. Mm. Do we get a sense of that? Do we get a sense of what is actually going on? You know, there's some films that really help us understand the setting. Do we get that out of this?
No, we don't. I'm really glad you're doing this top five list later in the show about most informative films. And I don't think the gunman should have strived to be, you know, a documentary or any kind of like political thriller necessarily to demonstrate exactly what's going on in the Congo. But a big issue for me is even just the fact that it's set there. So you could have set this story anywhere in the world. It doesn't matter where it is. But they chose the Congo. I'm like, great, you've chosen the Congo. Presumably you're doing that for a reason. You're making a Hollywood film that is going to be distributed further and wider than most other movies get from wherever they're made. If you made a Congolese filmmaker made a movie, never going to get as much airplay as this one does. So the fact that you've kind of set up this opportunity for me as a viewer, like I don't even think that I was holding the movie to too much account. It generated that in me by setting it in Congo, right?
You've got a responsibility, you'd say, as a filmmaker. If you're going to touch on a subject so raw, you've got a responsibility.
I think so, and I think where the responsibility fell down in this film is that it does just become this wallpaper backdrop for this story, which again is mainly about Westerners and what's going on in the lives of Westerners, and it focuses on the suffering in the life of this gunman, this paid hitman, and instead of focusing on the suffering that's going on in the backdrop in Congo. So as a Western viewer, my eyes could have been open to even some of the nuances or some of the issues that are going on in Congo that could somehow inform. It could have made this movie a better movie just by giving it more complexity about what this guy's doing. They throw in this subplot about him working for a charity group that
He's a good guy.
It's not even as insulting as towards the end of the film as his kind of summary plot point about what's going on at the Congo, where Pierre Morel, the director, it seems like he's trying to remind us that, oh yeah, we actually did discuss the Congo early on. We raised some issues and they're kind of in the background in this film. So like you're talking about Testament of War and it pointing to warfare.
Testament of youth, sorry.
As a testament to war, about war. And I came out of the government thinking about suffering, about war, about how as a Christian I should respond to loving my neighbors on the other side of the planet, what I could possibly do to affect change, all those kinds of things.
But almost despite the film.
I had to make myself do that because they raised this issue but then dropped it like a hot potato. And the reason I go on so much about the fact that they wasted the Congo and presenting to us as Westerners, like opening our eyes to it, why I go on about it, I think, is because The Gunman was such a poor film overall. And Sean Penn just sleepwalks through it. And the cast members that you mentioned earlier, great actors, but they get nothing to do.
Yeah.
The Gunman is at cinemas now. It's now showing, but don't bother.
Well, we've got a great opportunity coming up in the program to actually talk to a director of a film set in the Congo that actually goes the right way.
Yeah, I got to interview a documentary maker who went to the Congo, visited, and didn't just turn it into the gunman. Instead, he actually focused on what is happening in the Congo and particularly how people find hope among so much suffering and disturbance and just pain that goes on.
Okay, so hang on for that. It's not just the Avengers coming up.
It's just the Avengers. That interview is coming up.
Well, meanwhile, we're actually going to move into our soundtrack segment for the week. So soundtrack is that segment where in which we discuss basically the music that sits under the film. You know, you're not just watching, you're listening at the same time. And heroes have soundtracks. You know, and they're basically inseparable. And in fact, we're going to try and prove that later in the show because I'm going to quiz you, Ben, on my 10 favorite sort of soundtracks. Tracks and see if you how many you can name. Stay tuned for that because that's just going to be good fun. But basically, a director has two ways to go when he's doing his heroic film, when he introduces his key character.
He or she.
He or she. Director may introduce her or him. They basically can do one of two things. They can have something written to basically encapsulate the character of the hero. And there's a whole science about what sort of instruments you use in order to try and evoke the right feelings. Or they can pick something that's existing and fit that to the tracks of the film because it basically just fits the storyline so well. Now, there are lots of examples like that. Like Paul McCartney's Live and Let Die is just perfect, a perfect fit for James Bond, okay? I'm Shipping Up to Boston by the Dropkick Murphys. You know, it was just a song that sat there. Didn't do terribly well in the charts. Then it got associated with The Departed, and everybody thought this is the best film ever.
That's a great choice.
Yeah, I know. So every now and again, you can find just the right song as far as a director or a writer. I think it's writers who do this. Anyway, no.
Speaking as a writer, Mark.
Speaking as a writer, I feel we're responsible for all the good stuff.
So what have you picked?
Well, I'm looking at this week basically a piece that kicked off the soundtrack for Batman Forever.
Snows, my eyes become large and the light that you shine can't be seen.
Kiss from a Rose is a song from Seal's second album. And the interesting thing about this is that it was actually released in 1994 and didn't really do terribly well. It was out there, okay. But then it's re-released in 1995 as part of the Batman Forever film soundtrack. And that is huge. You know,
and a lot of people would remember that song way more than Batman Forever.
Exactly. And the two, but I mean, it's one of those cases. Thanks very much for ditching my film. It's one of those cases.
Your film, you made that?
Oh, yes. I don't want to brag. No, really. It's actually a very memorable scene in the film where in which you actually have Batman standing over the grave of his parents and the snow falling and that sort of stuff. And this is the song that gets built in. And it's one of those classic cases where just the right film can be worked in. It actually became Record of the Year, Song of the Year, Best Male Pop Vocal Performance well after its release, which is a fantastic thing for, you know, a song to achieve, but even better because that shows you how film and stuff can actually meld together so well.
So that's your first choice for soundtrack this week. And so later in the show, got another soundtrack choice, but that's where you're going to quiz me on superhero themes.
I'm going to hit you up with all the best sort of like instrumental stuff, see how much you can pick out of that.
Okay. Okay, I'm ready. As you may have gathered from us pretty much saying it all the time throughout this episode, this is a superhero week. The Avengers Age of Ultron is in cinemas, so it's had us thinking about superheroes. We've gone a little bit superhero crazy, and so has Bible Society CEO and social commentator Greg Clark in his regular segment where he joins us on the Bible Society to tell us what the Bible has to say about a particular topic. Well, this week, Greg's going to tell us what the Bible has to tell us about superheroes.
He committed no sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. They're the words in 1 Peter 2:22, describing Jesus of Nazareth. Well, the explosion of superheroes in today's culture took me by surprise. Weren't they the obsession of the early days of the modern world, before everyone was flying around themselves in aeroplanes and surfing the world on the internet? But superheroes today are big business. Every second movie is about them. From the Fantastic Four to the Incredibles for your kids, every superhero has a complete range of merchandise to demonstrate just how much they've taken over culture. But today's heroes can be hard to distinguish from the villains. There are drug dealers who are praised for their resourcefulness, violent bullies who are held up as role models. How are we meant to know who the good guys are anymore? At one level, this is actually helpful, because the perfect hero can be kind of uninteresting and very hard to believe. Everyone has a flaw, don't they? Everyone is covering for something or exaggerating their abilities in one way or another. Perhaps now we just have a more realistic take on our heroes. Well, heroes in the so-called real world are certainly the warts and all types. We see this chiefly on the sporting field. I mean, sports heroes are great. We love their courage, their strength, their perseverance, but then they yell at the referee or they do something unmentionable in a nightclub, and all those heroics seem to count for nothing. The hero and the villain are hand in hand before the rugby league judiciary every week. But this desire for a hero is very close to the human heart. Perhaps it's part of our desperate need to be rescued, or our hope that someone out there has everything under control. Perhaps we need to know that where we are weak, someone else can be strong. But every hero is going to let us down. Jesus is the only hero I've so far come across who doesn't have that fatal flaw. Our Bible verse tells us that he was without blemish, without fault, without flaw. What I find amazing is that he's still so extraordinarily captivating despite being perfect. I haven't seen that in any of the superhero films I've watched so far. In the end, I think we all want to be heroes rather than villains, but we're so unreliable. Thank God that there is someone to step in for us at just the right moment with just the right superpowers to save us from ourselves.
Mark, are you surprised that midway through the show, when we're focusing on superheroes and we just had a segment of the show called What the Bible Has to Say About Superheroes, that turns out Jesus is the superhero?
You know, there might be a connection between that and the fact that we're Christians, but I don't want to go out on a limb.
I was going to make it obvious, Mark.
Okay. Well, listen, Ben got fired up earlier about how Sean Penn's assassin movie, The Gum and Waste, its exotic and incendiary setting, the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Yes, it did waste that setting.
We actually had to throw a bucket of water over him. I'd just like to say a little bit of a quick shout out to Javier, our producer this week, who's because Fernando's on holiday somewhere in some exotic location, I expect. Anyway, and so he's basically been throwing buckets of water on Ben all day because of the Republic of Congo. Anyway, so Ben lamented how this opportunity was wasted and an opportunity to share with the Western world's watching audience something about the Congo and what it actually battles. Well, there's a new documentary directed by Bryce McClellan, which does what The Gunman does not. Now, Bryce and journalist Josh Moore went to the Congo to talk to locals about what it's like to live life in the traumatized, turbulent nation. And they were particularly interested in finding out how, amid the horrors of war and pain and civil unrest, people could actually believe in God. I mean, let alone have faith in his son, Jesus Christ. So Ben got Bryce to step out from behind the camera to discuss his doco, Jesus in the Congo.
Bryce, thanks for joining us. Now, before we talk about your documentary, your time in the Congo, I wanted to quickly ask you your thoughts on The Gunman. I know you haven't seen The Gunman, but how do you feel when you hear about there's a movie set in the Congo but doesn't really use the Congo, the backdrop, for anything much more than wallpaper? Do you think there should be more movies focusing on what's actually happening in the Congo?
Well, I was pretty disappointed to hear that it is just sort of an exotic, exciting locale for action. So that was disappointing. But I think that not just movies in Congo that we need, but we actually need news in the Congo. And I think that's probably why there hasn't been so many films set in the Congo, because people don't know about it. It's not reported on the news. Maybe if that came first, then we could have the movies later.
Now, is that one of the reasons that you and journalist Josh Moore went to Congo to make this documentary, which is self-funded? Like, I imagine it's a pretty demanding production. What was it that enticed you to go there in the first place?
Well, my friend and producer Josh was interested in the Congo before I was, and he talked to me about it. And as he was talking to me about it, I realized how little I knew.
What was his interest in it?
he knew a bishop there from some travels that he'd done there, and he was writing a biography of him.
And so, and you didn't know much about it, and so why did you then sign on to join Josh to go to the Congo to make this documentary?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Thank you.
I said that so I can now think of an answer. I think it was the fact that so little was known about it.
Yeah.
That's what interested me. More people have died in Congo than probably any other country in the world.
Really?
Yeah.
Far out, man. So this is quite a dangerous place from what I understand, war-torn place. Can you share with us a couple of key insights that you gained from your time there? You were there for a couple of weeks. You must have seen a lot of amazing stuff. What's it really like to be in the Congo?
Yeah, well, it's very unstable, obviously. It's very unstable, obviously, and there's a lot of danger around. But a lot of the people there, you wouldn't think that their lives are in constant peril the way they live their lives. They're full of joy. They're full of hope.
Really? Really?
Yeah. Not everyone. I mean, a lot of people, a lot of journalists say there's an entire generation that has post-traumatic stress disorder from the Congo War. But, you know, knowing what you know about the history of Congo, going there, you might be surprised about how joyful they are and how excited they are to be living there. And part of that is the lack of perspective. They don't know what the West is like. They think the rest of the world is a lot like their country when it's not. But, you know, a lot can be said for their courage and their faith.
Yeah, yeah. And so what did you and Josh hope to capture, or what do you think you did capture in the documentary Jesus in Congo?
We hope to capture the people there, essentially, whatever they were like, whether they were distraught, whether they were, torn apart by war, or whether they were joyful. That's what we wanted to capture. And we got that full spectrum. So obviously there's a lot of bad things in Congo. I'm not trying to minimize that, but the people there were really an inspiration. And if we've managed to capture their spirit on film, then I think that's a success.
Were there any particular people that did stand out to you? I know you interviewed a lot of different Christians, especially you guys were quite interested in hearing the stories of Christians. Actually, I'll firstly ask you, why was that? Why did you want to talk to Christians? And then secondly, was it anyone that really stood out to you?
Yeah, we wanted to speak to Christians because we're making a Christian film, and we didn't want to kind of make the Congo film. We just wanted to make a film about Christianity in Congo. In terms of Christians who stood out.
But particularly because the Congo is such a war-torn, ravaged country that it seems to be from the outside, and I don't even know too much about it, but it really seems to be imploding for a long period of time.
Yeah.
Did you want to know what sustains people in that that place?
Well, in the West, I think we ask questions about why does God allow suffering? And that's a good question to ask, but in the West, there isn't that much suffering. So if we could go to possibly one of the worst places in the world and ask that question, it has a lot more meaning.
Yeah.
So that was our objective.
Yeah. And so any particular people that stood out to you from your couple of weeks there?
Yeah. I mean, there were some people who were just, paragons of virtue, and they were interesting enough. But I remember Timon had been persecuted by his community, essentially, because they thought he was a spy and had to flee his country. And he was only just starting to return to Congo because he's a dentist. And he had forgiven the people who had attacked him and actually had dinner with them and prayed with them. And it was just a...
Wow.
He wasn't superhuman. He was just an average person. He managed to achieve that level of forgiveness over someone who had hurt him so much.
Wow. So Jesus in Congo is the documentary. Bryce, where can we see the documentary, or how can people get in contact with you so they can see it?
Well, we're screening a documentary, having our first screening on the 2nd of May. It's at Village Church in Annandale. Tickets can be bought online at jesusincongo.com.
Fantastic. Bryce, thank you very much for joining us on
Thank
the Big Picture.
And we really encourage you to actually get along and have a look at the film. Look, personally, I also want to encourage you to interact with the show. If you've got an opinion on war or heroes or things like that, or you want to reflect on something you've heard in the show, find us on our Facebook page. That's a good start.
Yeah, look for us on Twitter. We're out there.
We're out there, honestly, if you can't find us, you're not trying.
So it's on you.
It's on you now. Come on. The email address, tellthebigpicture@gmail.com.
Yeah, so please, tellthebigpicture@gmail.com.
You can help interact with the show. You want to be technical, send us an audio recording of your opinion. We'll see if we can play it during the show.
That's a really good idea.
I'll throw
or give
that
us
down.
Some suggestions of top fives, or maybe there's like a theme or an idea in movies that you really want discussed, and the Big Picture is the place that wants to discuss it.
We're your venue. And speaking of top fives, the top five this week is my most informative films. Okay, we've been talking about
most
films,
informative films
that, and I don't mean boring, by the way. I mean films that are actually going to take you somewhere in your mind to where you've never been before. And that's basically, like, spurred on by Bryce and Josh's documentary this week in our top five, we take a look at films that are really dangerous. I mean, there are dangerous films that basically fill gaps in our heads. You know, the Da Vinci Code's one. If you know nothing, they can tell you rubbish. Okay, and that's a dangerous film because people start believing stuff about history or things like that that's just not true. But the dangerous film, the powerful film that actually awakens people, that's another, you know, beast altogether. That's the one where in which I was not able to enter into a particular world until that film took me there and I could really experience and understand it. So let's kick off our list this week.
Five.
My fifth, you know, counting down film. Oh, look, there's so many because I'm a big fan of this sort of film, but 1998, Saving Private Ryan. There, as far as films go, films that have made huge stirs in the way that we understand something, Saving Private Ryan is hard to go past. The reason why is there's always been lots of war films prior to Saving Private Ryan, but in many respects they glorified war. Sure, they had heroic moments, the hero grasping his chest and maybe the flag as well as he, you know, drags himself along to save his buddies. But Saving Private Ryan basically told us, like as Thomas Hobbes says, how nasty, brutish and short life is. People who had actually been in World War II reflected on the film and said it was the closest experience they'd had to being back there. So basically it's Tom Hanks leading a group of US soldiers behind enemy lines to save, you know, a paratrooper.
But at the same time, Steven Spielberg's film seems to celebrate both honor and the horrors of war. Not celebrate, but present. In the same film, you get the honor and the horror.
And that's why I like it, because it actually helps us understand, say from a Christian perspective, that there are many different ways you can face death. You know, some of the characters face death confidently. There's a sniper character I particularly like who actually has a faith of some sort. And so he does his job to the end knowing that this is for him, not really the end. There's something beyond this. And then there are other characters who come off with all sorts of bravado, but who in the end face death badly, you know, because they really have nothing to hold on to. There's a one moving scene where a fellow just goes, wait, no, not yet. You know, and that's really, you know, all he has to say in the face of it. But let me take us on to our next pick.
Four.
This is a complete change of pace. 2009, Precious. I don't know if you saw Precious.
Yeah. Now, that is... I did not expect you to drop Precious in the list of most informative films.
The way I say it is, basically, if you haven't seen Precious, it's basically a New York City, Harlem sort of film, circa 1987, about an overweight, abused, illiterate teen who's called Precious, you know, by her mother. And it's really ironic because of the way that her mother treats her. She's anything but
that,
Precious.
That mum.
Yeah, I know. Right. It's terrible. And so she has this opportunity. She's you know, with child, with her second illegitimate child, and she's invited to enroll in an alternative school in hopes that her life can actually lead to a whole new different direction if her family will let her. Now, Precious is one of those films that reminds us just how privileged we are. Like, if you can afford a movie ticket and walk in, you're forgetting that you might actually be occupying a small percentage of this planet to begin
but
with.
Even just summarizing that plot sounds a little bit like some of those lamer, you know, like teacher-inspiring movies like Dangerous Minds, for example. Yeah,
this is not even... I mean, I like Good Will Hunting, but this is far more profound than that.
Yeah.
This is about the poverty trap. This is about showing how incredibly trapped you can become by abuse, by basically sin. How sin can wrap itself around and inform you from your earliest days when you grow up so that there is no way out unless somebody reaches in and changes things. And even when somebody reaches in and changes in, humanly speaking, it's almost impossible. You know, and so for me, as an informative film, as a Christian, I see a part of society and I remind myself, but for the grace of God, there go I. Well, let's take it on to number three. 2013's perfect slavery film. There have been a lot of slavery films, some good, some bad. It's a topic we really do need to address, but 12 Years a Slave does it better.
Perfect.
I think it is the best slavery film. Now, there are some really, really bad ones. Django Unchained. It's just an awful, awful way of addressing what is, in fact, a very important topic. So basically, if you haven't seen 12 Years a Slave, it's a true story about a fellow called Solomon Northrup, who was a free black man in upstate New York, who's then abducted and sold into slavery. Firstly, this is is a side of slavery that many of us just weren't aware of, that in fact actually to replenish the number of slaves that were needed, slaves were so valuable that free men were being, you know, kidnapped in the North and sold into the South. But secondly, it just reminds us, maybe like many films, I guess, you know, I could have picked a Holocaust film like The Pianist, it just reminds us how deeply evil we are. Because the truth is, slavery existed as normality,
you know, for a long, and for a very long time.
And we like to sort of sit back and look at it now. But I wonder at what point we will look back, or maybe history will look back on us and say, "Do you see what they tolerated for so long in that 21st century society?"
Oh, right, you
know, it's very easy. Right. So for me, that's the teaching film, to sort of get myself out of it and say, you know, it's really easy to see normal people behaving in a way that is just anything but normal.
Yeah.
Okay, well, look, let me take you, we're counting down our list and we're on to our next.
Two.
In 2012, a film came out, basically it was almost part documentary, that really shocked the world about the price we were prepared to pay for freedom. Zero Dark Thirty is basically a film that tells us all about the hunt for Al-Qaeda terrorist leader Osama bin Laden and how far we were prepared to go in order to bring about justice. How muddy, in fact, we were prepared to get. Now, for me, it's a great teaching film. Firstly, you just see the other side of the war on terror. In fact, where we are the terrorizers. You know, and that's something I think that is well worth us remembering, that it is very hard for human beings to bring about justice and not get our hands dirty. You know, God is perfect in the way that he can balance an infinite number of things occurring on this planet with a huge number of people so that justice always takes place. How he does that and how he will wrap that up on the last day will be something I personally will be waiting to see.
Yeah, I'm pretty interested too.
But here, when you look at Zero Dark Thirty, you see a picture of just how hard we can try to do what is right and how messy we get even as we try and do that. And for me, I think it's a great insight into the
Christian
character.
So that's your number two choice.
That's my number two choice.
Top five of most informative films. What's in at number one?
2008. Slumdog Millionaire.
Oh, yeah, good choice.
Now, the reason why I look at that is because, honestly, I don't think most of us knew anything about India.
You know, like, I think that's a fair assumption.
I don't want to say, there's lots of people out there going, no, I understood. And I understand. Okay, consider yourselves among the privileged minority. When Slumdog Millionaire came out, we saw not just the India of the dreams and India, like, you know, a trip to India and all sorts of things like that. No, we saw that whole cavernous underside of India and the people who struggle below the poverty line. We learn about this boy who has an opportunity to become a millionaire, but basically his name's Jamal, and he's sitting on a program. He has an opportunity to actually sort of answer the last question and lift himself out of poverty, and the only thing that film can assume is that he couldn't possibly know the answers to these questions because he's such a lower member of society, so he must be cheating somehow. And so the basis of the film is how could this kid, you know, actually become a millionaire? He's a cheat.
So it sounds like you picked this for a similar reason to Precious, which it gave you an audience as a window into poverty and people experiencing poverty and those trying to get out of it. What do you think is different, or why did you pick this at number one?
Well, you think that would be my reason, except that it's not.
Oh, hey. And here is what's the reason?
This is my number one thing, because the film Slumdog Millionaire has a really, really strong sense of destiny right through it, okay? Basically, if you follow the plot, what happens is that the kid is able to answer all of the questions in the film because of his life. His life has brought him to the point where he can actually tell the truth. Okay, and I look at that and I go, you know, that is life. If we look reasonably at our lives, we'll see that so much of our lives has been directing us and directing us and directing us towards information and conclusion. Now, from a Christian, I say that's God. And yet God brings us to a point where we have the opportunity to make a serious choice about our life, to speak the truth, to understand it, to admit it, that we've got all the answers we need. The question is, are we going to look at what's happening in our life and realize that? And that is me for this week. But before we go, how about a bit of Slumdog Millionaire?
I'll go for D, London.
Computer G, D, lock your jar. Jamal Malik, you're absolutely right!
it's getting hot in here.
Are you nervous?
What? Am I nervous? It's you who's in the hot seat, my friend.
Oh, yes.
Sorry.
Bloody hell, he's got prey on the run.
Finally.
A few hours ago,
you were giving chai for the Foonwallas, and now you're richer than they will ever be. Walla player. Ladies and gentlemen, Walla player!
I love Slumdog Millionaire. It's one of the small town heroes, if you like, in our Hero Week. And we're looking at soundtrack part two now, the super soundtrack. That soundtrack which is actually written to invoke heroes. Now, I think this is so much fun. I got carried away. And I basically...
It sounds a little bit like it.
I've assembled a list of...
Assemble!
My 10 favourite super soundtracks. Really short and fast, Ben. You got your pen ready?
I do.
If you're playing at home, people, how many of these can you name?
Five.
Okay, so 10 tracks in there.
Okay.
I don't know how many people got at home. I'm sure there's some people going, play more of that, play more of that. But what did you get? What did you get?
In there.
So first one.
I want to say the Thunderbirds. Was that?
Yeah, it was a classic count.
Oh, it's the Thunderbirds. Oh, good. Okay, I do want to say the Thunderbirds.
Ben,
and that was number
correct.
One.
Correct.
Was number two Superman?
It was. You can't hear that without wanting to run around, you know, the
or
lounge room with
the
your hands
room, as a case
stretched
maybe.
Out in front of you. Yeah, yeah.
The third one, Wonder Woman.
Yes.
That's a fantastic
that's
theme
beautiful.
Song.
Beautiful. People should play that more often.
I'm really glad you picked Get Smart at number four.
Yeah,
like
that's
Maxwell
brilliant.
Smart as a superhero. That's great. The Batman theme song from the TV show was number
Adam
five.
Adam West. Stand, no chest padding. You know, that's just, that guy was
that's what it conjures for you. Okay,
100% Adam West.
I was thinking about Kapow and Sock and all that. James Bond theme was the next one. It was number seven. Is that Mission Impossible?
No, it wasn't. But it was something really, really close.
So like Mission Impossible.
Yeah,
what,
yeah.
What is that?
The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Oh, right.
Napoleon Solo like was one of my great heroes as a kid. It was
There's
just
a
fantastic.
New film version of that coming out.
If I
out.
Could have had a cravat as a kid, I would have walked around with that.
There's a new film version of that coming out, I think, later in the year. Number eight, Greatest American Hero. Welcome back.
And we'd all forgotten it quite neatly.
That song's so great.
There's
number nine, I have no idea what that was.
Now look, I had to include it because, you know, half the planet love it. That's Naruto. Okay,
well,
that's,
what did you just say?
Yeah, there you go. Moving on.
So I'm in the other half of the planet.
Yeah,
then.
I'm sorry. For all those manga fans and anime fans who were just, you know, offended, Ben, we'll apologize later.
And the last one, Indiana Jones?
Indiana Jones.
Please tell me it's Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. Man, I think you just did like 8 out of 10.
I didn't do too badly.
Not too shabby. You might have even got 9. No, 8, because you didn't get Man from U.N.C.L.E. I won't hold that against you. Listen, before we finish, can you just indulge me a little? Can we just have a little bit more of Wonder Woman? Javier. Wonder Woman. love when we're fighting for your rights to set in tights. It's just a lyric I wish I'd written.
That's a lyrical masterpiece, the theme from Wonder Woman. So that takes us out of soundtrack this week and brings us finally to the moment that we've all, at least we've been waiting for some time, because we've been talking about it so long through this show. This is the What Your Kids Are Watching segment this week. But basically, it's what everyone's going to be watching, really. It's Avengers Age of Ultron. That's at cinemas this week, the sequel to the massive superhero hit from a couple of years ago, The Avengers. It's here, it's at cinemas this week. Let's take something from the clip and then let's discuss.
Here we all are. With nothing but our wit and our will to save the world. So stand and fight.
No way we all get through this.
I got no plans tomorrow night.
I'm always picking up after you, boys.
We can tear them apart. From the inside.
That's the best you can do!
Sorry, I love those yelled lines. You know, the heroes always have that one sort of.
I was just stuck on. Is it Nick Fury, that Samuel L. Jackson character? We've just got our wit and our will to defeat the enemy. What about all your superhero powers?
Well,
what about those?
If people haven't been following the storyline so far, in the last film, S.H.I.E.L.D. as an organization was basically destroyed. And now the Avengers are basically, you know, exhausted and scattered, and they need a bit of a hiatus from stopping threats to the world.
Superheroes need a rest too.
So Tony Stark, you know, aka Iron Man, decides to jumpstart a long dormant peacekeeping program he's had on the shelf.
As you do, know,
next to Windows 4.1 or something. He's in this thing called Ultron. Now, it's a self-aware, self-teaching artificial intelligence, and this is somehow going to start, you know, policing the world and putting down bad guys. However, strangely, his plan backfires, and Ultron decides...
this wouldn't be a movie otherwise.
And no, it all worked out fine, and we all went home. Yeah. So Ultron decides that the enemy is actually humanity, you know, and so that the real problem in the world is humanity, and so Ultron decides the best way to deal with things is to get rid of humanity. This, of course, requires the attendance of Iron Man and Captain America and Thor and the Hulk and Black Widow and Hawkeye and everybody else. Nick Fury turns up again, and basically they're all there to stop him. And along the way, we get to see some other characters from the Marvel Universe, Pietro and Wanda Maximoff, those, you know, crazy twins back, and also a character many people have been hanging out for, I understand, which is Vision the Android. So, you know, everything is there. It's epic, and it's likely to be huge at the box office.
We did massive. It was the biggest film. When was Avengers out? A couple of years ago. Yeah, it was the biggest film by a long way.
It actually holds the worldwide record for first weekend box office sales. There is no film bigger for that weekend,
which is quite amazing given superhero movies have been huge now for, let's say, I reckon 10 or 15 years, pretty much since the Dark Knight and the Spider-Man films came out. And they continue to hit screens. And I think they were looking like they might have started waning a couple of years ago until The Avengers. And then The Avengers really reignited again how big superheroes are on screen. But now it seems more targeted just towards The Avengers. Like, they seem to be the ones that... I mean, X-Men have been doing quite well, but really Avengers, people, young and small, men and women, are hanging out for The Avengers. Like, it's quite a phenomenal... thing.
What do you think that people are actually reaching for, like, in these heroes? Because, like you said, it is so broad, the market, that people are just getting behind it. It's almost as if it's put its finger on something that is more intrinsic to the human soul than is just a good plot idea.
Yeah, I think people are drawn to superheroes, as we discussed earlier in the show. People love superheroes. They love the idea of a savior figure coming in and rescuing us. I think that hits deep into our souls as people that, you know, kind of, whether you want to admit it or not, you know, you can't rescue yourself from so many things in life, whether it be massive trials or really everyday things. Often you cannot get yourself out of a situation. I think what superheroes strike in the core of us is we're desperate for a savior. Avengers assembles a whole bunch of them that are a bit of a motley crew. You know, they bicker and they banter and that kind of stuff, and they've got all these various superpowers that contribute to this amazing tapestry of superheroes on screen, superheroic efforts on screen. And I think in a better way than like the X-Men movies have done. I think that they've assembled all these different characters in the one movie. But what also is going on then is you get this almost perfect storm of self-sacrifice as well.
That's what I think that's really key. I think that's fantastic, because what you've actually hit on there is something that seems to be married to the human idea of heroism. And that is, you cannot just be great.
Yeah.
You've actually got to expect, you look at every one of these heroes, they have got to trade something of themselves during this film.
Yeah, you can't just be a savior figure who isn't selfless at the same time as well. And even for like the wisecracking and really quite self-absorbed Tony Stark, who's Iron Man, you see in him selflessness and sacrifice that comes through in what he does for people. So yeah, I think what audiences are drawn to beyond the massive scope and spectacle of these films and the Avengers film that Joss Whedon directed, and he's here for the sequel again. The first one, people loved the size and the scope and the magnitude, all those kind of big words. But I think also people really gravitate towards savior figures and those who are selfless and self-sacrificed on screen as well.
Well, I think you've hit that up. There are basically two archetypes operating in Age of Ultron. The first one we've just been discussing is the fact that as human beings, we realize that rescue is on the cards and that we
need it.
We are wired to see a heroic figure and appreciate that has to involve sacrifice, that somebody's got to die. But there's another archetype operating in Age of Ultron too, which is a little less comfortable for us. Let's play this clip.
I was designed to save the world. People will look to the sky and see hope. I'll take that from them first. There's only one path to peace. Their extinction.
That's the thing that we find very, very hard to understand. And it used to be a popular archetype, and it's not a popular one now. And that is that humanity actually is the problem. Now, if you went back 100 years and looked at stories, then you would see that the root of our problems, the root of our evil, is always traced back to humanity. We actually have a struggle inside of ourselves and we need outside assistance. But that's turned on its head in this film. It's the evil guy who's come to the conclusion that humanity has the problem, and it's going to be the heroes who are going to set him right and say, actually, no, we're kind of fine. Leave us alone.
I was reading some comments that Joss Whedon, the director of these films, has made in the past, and he's an outspoken atheist, a guy who just doesn't believe that there is a God, and yet he's a guy who in his movies, and these ones included, reckons that effectively like the world's hopeless, but he wants to give hope. He actually wants to inject hope within his movies, and you get that contrasting idea with James Spader is the actor who's playing the voice of Ultron in Age of Ultron, and some of the things that he said about his character Ultron I found fascinating, which include that Ultron is this self-created entity who's got something of a biblical perspective on the world. And I think what James Spader is getting at, the biblical perspective, is what you just hit at, which is humanity is the problem. Like it or not, humanity is the source largely of everything that's going wrong on the planet. And here in this movie, it's going to be represented as this robot trying to smash everybody. But I was fascinated to use the word biblical to describe that.
Now watch for this in the plot, because what will actually happen at some point, the general answer to the idea that humanity is the problem is, yet there is still hope. Look for where they place the hope. Often it's a picture of a small child being helped by some woman across the road, or a soldier who's still doing his job, or a cop who's sort of standing up. And then we rally and the heroes go, yeah, for their sake, for these common people. I mean, Spider-Man was saved by a train full of general onlookers.
Yeah.
You know, so the hope is often placed in us.
Which is weird, given if we're the source of the problem, why are
exactly.
we also the solution?
Yeah, and this is more a motive argument than really a logical argument. I think it's really worth seeing, though. And if you can have a conversation afterwards, you might as well ask, in fantasy, we've done a great job of rescuing ourselves, but how well have we really done in reality? And we've talked about rescue all this show, and basically we want to say that heroes are something we really do want to look for in this world, but if we keep looking to ourselves, we're not really going to get the hero that we need.
Yeah, so go back to the What Does the Bible Have to Say About Superheroes segment earlier in the show and listen to Greg point towards Jesus and how he demonstrates such amazing attributes of being a savior, selfless sacrifice, and how he is the answer for humanity's problems rather than ourselves.
So, well, that, That's what you're going to be watching. I'm going to be watching. 90% of the population is going to be watching this week. But look, what else is coming up this week? What have we got in terms of film? Is there space in any cinema screen anywhere for anything else?
I was going to say, as if anyone cares what else is around apart from Avengers, Age of Ultron. So in a week where this massive movie is out, other film companies get pretty smart and they don't tend to put too much up against it. We mentioned Testament of Youth earlier in the show. There's another film that Dustin Hoffman is in called Boy Choir.
Yeah, I know. This is another real fringe film. I think that, you know, again, the struggles between a choir master and a boy.
Yeah, even the fact it's called Boy Choir. I mean, maybe it's going to be Billy Elliot's version of Whiplash. Maybe that's possible. That's what could transpire in this movie. But I think the fact that it's at cinemas up against the Avengers sequel says something about this drama about, as you just mentioned, a kid and a mentor and, you know, what's going to go on there. But anyway, that's the cinema's Boy Choir. Also out around the place, Gallipoli, because it's Anzac Week, Gallipoli is being reinstated at some cinemas around the place. I highly recommend people rush out to see that great film from 1981 that Peter Weir directed. Yeah. Mel Gibson's in it. Excellent look. It's a defining war movie from Australia, and I think really captures the innocence, optimism, selflessness, heartbreak, torment, all those things that go on with war movies. You get the heartbreak and the futility of war encapsulated in this amazing final scene. Gallipoli is worth watching just for the final shot.
Oh, yeah. Honestly, if you have not actually seen Gallipoli, and it's possible, go and see it on the big screen. I can't think of a better way.
If you haven't seen Gallipoli, you're un-Australian, and you need to change that.
Yes. If there was a double play, Avengers plus Gallipoli, that would be, yeah.
So that's what's happening this week at cinemas. On DVD and Blu-ray, to give a quick note to a few interesting releases this week, there was this remake of Annie, the musical that came out in cinemas last year, and pretty much no one saw it as far as I understand.
Jamie Foxx, it was basically the black American version of Annie. They basically cast all the key
characters.
And
it just went nowhere in late December. Jamie Foxx in it, Australia's Rose Byrne and Cameron Diaz. And I haven't seen it. I've got no real interest in seeing it.
But if only for a segue to another great family film that's coming out this week.
Yeah, that's right. The best thing to be said for Annie is that it's a musical, and so is Sound of Music. And that was a much more popular musical. It's celebrating its 50th anniversary. It's been re-released. This movie, for me, as much as I try not to like it, I really do. And it's amazing that you can craft a family musical with Nazis as the backdrop. This, I find Sound of Music is still a bit staggering at how much it can withstand. It's so cheesy and so often kitsch, and there's so much about it that you really shouldn't like. It can withstand, it almost, not just withstands cynicism, it almost defies you to be a cynic. That's the Sound of Music. It's re-released again.
These are some of my favorite things.
See what you did there.
I can see that. Look, on the small screen, it is Anzac Week. We are well and truly in Anzac Week. So, April 20, Our World War. It kicked off last night. If you haven't had a chance to actually start seeing this, the three-part factual drama series from the ABC continues tonight and will go on to tomorrow night. So that's well worth seeing. Also, look, everybody is doing everything Anzac. So Sam Neill's special, Why Anzac, about his personal family history, and he goes to Gallipoli and progresses through that story and basically tells the story of a nation at the same time. Even Good Game is doing an Anzac special, which I can't wait to see. I haven't seen the preview of that, but it must be amazing. I think that the only other thing of note that I really want to draw attention to, and again, it's not something I'm really keen about, but I mentioned it last week, the Agony series is back on, and this week they're doing The Agony of God. This is more like a series which you want to watch to see what other people think. Not to get happy about, but to more sort of sense.
It's called agony.
Yeah, I know, but more to understand just how little people understand of our God. And if you get a picture of that, then you're well presented to actually reveal them to him. In print this week, something much more fun, a much more cartoonish hero. I do an article in Eternity magazine on Adventure Time. Adventure Time is a brilliant cartoon sort of thing that I think some people might treat early on like The Simpsons or something like that. Should I be more worried about this? Should my kids watch this? But this is a crazy sort of story about Finn the human and Jake the dog. My kids want me to mention this. I really think you'd enjoy it as a family. It's also a great idea for a Christian ideal of friendship. So I write about that in Eternity. And Eternity is also, on a much more serious note, is talking about the need for a hero in Kenya, in the face of the Kenya massacre, a no-holds-barred look at the massacre of 147 students, mostly Christian, at Garissa University at the hands of Muslim extremists. And really, the pointy end of religion and why we need a hero in society today. What about you, Ben? Is there something else you want to draw our attention to?
Well, speaking of heroes, Mark, and as we come to the conclusion of our superhero edition of The Big Picture, as we've been talking so much about the Avengers and all kinds of other heroic actions, I wanted to focus on two other superheroes, you and me, and how you can actually see us in the flesh. You don't have to just listen to us. You can see us because there are videos of The Big Picture available on the Eternity website, available on Hope's website, available on Insight's website. So if you want to see two remarkably different, I don't even know how else to describe us as superheroes.
I don't wear a hat.
I don't know what our superpowers are apart from talking about movies and TV and hope and helping all of us, we hope, to think more deeply about those things. Check out the videos this week. That's what's around this week. Now, coming up on the show next week, what are you going to talk about?
Well, look, next week we are basically going to have our... Well, let me introduce this slightly differently. If I say the phrase foreign film to most people, they get the shakes.
Apart from me.
Apart from you who love it. What we're going to do is we're going to revitalize foreign film for you. So next week, we're going to do it together, buddy. One of the things we'll be looking at is some of our favorite overseas flicks. We're going to include a lot. We're going to get very Japanese-y, frankly, from my perspective. We're going to talk about the release of Miyazaki's collective works. But basically, this is a chance to actually see the fun in foreign. Okay, so if you're thinking Fringe is not where I'm at, we're going to convince you otherwise next week.
The fun in foreign. I'm Ben McKechnie.
I'm still Mark Hadley.